Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. My favorite way to enjoy the night sky is with the naked eye. And sometimes I'll step into the backyard for like 2 minutes before I go to bed to see what the moon and the stars look like that night. And it's so convenient because I don't have to take anything with me. Now, don't get me wrong, I love looking at things with my telescope too, but I do that less often. Now, of course, if Jupiter and Saturn are in view, it's always worth the effort to set up the telescope. The moon is pretty spectacular with a telescope too, especially during the first quarter. Since the sun is shining on it at an angle from our view, we can see deep shadows cast by the craters and the mountains. Deep space objects are mind-boggling to me. My favorite one is the Orion Nebula. It's visible to the naked eye under mildly light-polluted skies, but then you put the telescope on it and you see that it's actually a giant cloud of dust and gas illuminated by a bunch of young, white-hot stars. It is beautiful. But some people like to do more than just gaze at the celestial objects. They want to observe something happening out there. They are citizen scientists, which means that they observe and record what they see, and then they share their findings with organizations that compile scientific databases. Astronomy is the oldest science, and it's one of the only sciences that still relies on citizen scientists. Tonight's guest is an amateur astronomer and citizen scientist who records a phenomenon called occultations. I'm going to let him tell you what an occultation is. But I do want to say that if you enjoy traveling to places that have amazing night sky experiences, and you have a telescope with a video camera that can connect to your laptop, you can also chase occultations. Our guest has traveled around the world to record these observations, giving us another definition for a night sky tourist. If you've listened to this podcast for some time, then you've already been acquainted with our guest, Ted Blank. Ted was a guest on our very first episode, and he's also returned for a few more episodes. And he also did a Q&A segment in our first year. Ted is a NASA Solar System Ambassador, the Vice President of the International Dark Sky Discovery Center, a board member of the Fountain Hills Dark Sky Association, and he sings in a barbershop quartet. Please join me in welcoming back to the podcast, Ted Blank. Thank you for joining us on the Night Sky Tours podcast once again.
You're welcome.
You are my most repeated guest of all. So thank you for joining us.
Honored.
So we have a really interesting topic to talk about, and that is the topic of occultations. And for people who wonder if because it has the word occult in the word, it doesn't have anything to do with witchcraft, does it? What is it?
Yes, completely. It's all about witchcraft. It's terrible. it does share the root of the word occult, which is darkness. Occultations are simply events in space where one object passes in front of the other and blocks its light, thereby darkening it. So that's why it's called an occultation. An eclipse is a special case of an occultation, where the two objects are roughly the same size. So a solar eclipse is when the moon passes in front of the sun. And due to the relative sizes and distances, the moon is 400 times closer to us than the sun. And it also just happens by coincidence to be 400 times smaller in diameter than the sun. So the two appear to be the same size in the sky. So we are lucky to live when we do. The moon is slowly moving away from Earth over millions of years, and there will come a time when the moon never appears large enough in the sky to actually fully cover the sun. And children will read about things called solar eclipses, but no one will have ever seen one. We are very lucky to live when we do. So that's a kind of occultation. But the kind that I study, along with hundreds of other volunteers and people from NASA and research institutions, are occultations of stars by asteroids. Out in the asteroid belt, which is that big empty space between Mars and Jupiter, there are millions of asteroids, hundreds of thousands of which are large enough that if you're in the right place on Earth at the right time at night, you might see one of them pass in front of a star as it continues on its orbit around the sun through the sky. Typically, asteroids are dark enough and small enough that you really can't see them, even with a pair of binoculars. Sometimes you can glimpse one in a telescope, but they tend to be pretty dark and almost invisible. So when one of them goes in front of a star, the star simply blinks out for the amount of time it takes the asteroid to completely pass in front of it and the star to come out the other side, just like sliding your hand sideways over a light. When your hand's in front of the light, you can't see the light. And then when your hand finishes moving, it comes out the other side. So that's an occultation. And given that we know how fast most of these asteroids are actually traveling, by timing the amount of time that the star disappears, we have an accurate measurement of the size, the diameter of the asteroid. And that can be accurate to within 1 kilometer, plus or minus 1 kilometer, at a distance typically of 400 million kilometers away. There's no measurement in astronomy that gives you that level of accuracy that doesn't cost $1 billion to basically send a spacecraft out and take a picture. So we are the cheapest source of accurate astronomical information about asteroids on the planet, and we're proud to do that as volunteers.
So what's the process of setting things up? What all do you guys have to do to be able to capture an occultation and be able to get the data that you need to measure it and the other things that they do with that?
Well, if you are having a video camera attached to your telescope is kind of the first step. That's what we mostly use. And you'd point your video camera at that star maybe 2 minutes before the predicted time of the occultation and record for maybe 4 minutes and hope that somewhere in the middle of that, the prediction is accurate enough that you'll actually see the star disappear behind the asteroid. So the question becomes, where do these predictions come from? So I'm a member of an amateur group called the International Occultation Timing Association, IOTA. And some of our members are true rocket scientists. And every month, they make a 60-day prediction by comparing the orbits of all known asteroids with the positions of all known stars. Think about multiplying those two numbers together.
You get
very large combination of candidates. And then they filter those based upon, is the Earth going to be in the line between the asteroid and the star? Is the star bright enough to see in the first place? Because there are many more faint stars than there are bright ones. So if they say, well, you know, this star is one of the faintest stars in the sky, and it's going to be occulted by a particular asteroid, but I can't see the star in my telescope because it's too faint, there's no sense in trying to capture this event. So, and since there are many more faint stars than bright ones, there are many more candidate occultations of asteroids of faint stars, and very few of really bright stars. And almost never, maybe once every 2 or 3 years, will there be a star that you can see naked eye that will blink out behind an asteroid. And when those happen, we do our best to publicize that to the public, because that's an amazing thing to observe.
So these people who do these calculations, sounds like a good job for somebody who loves math.
Exactly.
So how many telescopes does it take to gather data from one occultation for them to be able to get the information that they need?
One telescope observing the disappearance of the star behind the asteroid gives you information about the orbit of the asteroid. Because stars are essentially infinitely small points. So at the moment that that star disappears, if you have an accurate time and an accurate measure of your location on Earth, you really know a lot more about the asteroid's orbit than you did before. So it really helps us get asteroid orbital improvement knowledge. But it turns out that, try to imagine shining a flashlight on an orange and you're maybe 10 feet away from the wall of your house. So you shine the flashlight on the orange, and on the wall of your house, you see the shadow of the orange. It's a little larger than the orange is because the light rays from the flashlight are spreading out between the orange and the wall. But stars are so far away that the little tiny shadow that the star projects of the asteroid on Earth turns out to be exactly the same size and shape as the asteroid itself out in space. So try to imagine this. If you have an asteroid that's, say, 50 miles across, that star projects a shadow of the asteroid 50 miles in diameter, and it sweeps across Earth as the asteroid goes through space. And so if you're anywhere in that shadow, you'll see the star disappear. If you're right in the center of the shadow, you'll see the star disappear for the longest time because that's the widest diameter of the asteroid. If you move 20 miles north or 20 miles south, you'll see the star disappear for a much shorter time because up near the poles, the asteroid is narrower because they're usually spherical, circular in projection on the sky. So try to imagine that 10 people go out and they're all 10 miles apart or 5 miles apart. They spread out like a picket fence north to south. Each of them gets a measurement of the diameter of the asteroid at the latitude, if you want to call it, where they saw the star go behind it. If you connect the dots on all of those measurements, you can actually see the outline of the asteroid appear as you connect the dots of the outlines of those measurements.
So you actually see the shape of the asteroid.
With enough volunteer observers, the more observers, the finer resolution. It's the same as if you have a 640 by 480 TV monitor like the old days in computers, upgrade to HD, and then upgrade to 4K. Everything, you get better and better resolution on your TV. It's the same thing. The more volunteer observers we have for a particular event, the more lines we draw across the asteroid, and the finer resolution we can get of its shape.
So this week, earlier this week, on July 25th, you were able to record an occultation from the observatory in your backyard here in Fountain Hills, Arizona. And I think you told me that the shadow went from, was it from Flagstaff to Tucson?
That's correct. This was an asteroid that was almost 150 miles in diameter out in space. And it was occulting a fairly bright star. And the shadow was moving slowly enough that I actually recorded this event. The star disappeared for over 13 seconds for me. Typically, asteroids are small enough that we can actually measure disappearances as short as 2 or 3 tenths of a second. But in this case, the asteroid was huge and moving slowly. So my observation was 13.6 seconds, and I was near the center, near the equator of the asteroid. And so far, six other observers have turned in their data, and eventually there will be a publication to the Minor Planet Center at Harvard, which holds all of our data. And any scientist in the future who wants to know something about this particular asteroid, which is named, by the way, Ophelia. So Ophelia now has six measurements or chords measured across its diameter. And that data will all feed into the Minor Planet Center's database about this asteroid. So when a scientist someday says, I'd like to study this asteroid, they can go and retrieve all historical observations of it in the database. And 90% of them will have been provided by amateur observers like me.
And since I've met you, you've gone all over the place to do this. Obviously, it's something you really enjoy doing. Since I've known you, you've been to Argentina and South Africa. Of course, you do a lot here in Arizona. What are some other really interesting places you've gone to do this?
Back when the New Horizons spacecraft was almost at the end of its 15-year flight to get to Pluto, to take those beautiful close-up pictures that it took, the scientists realized that beyond Pluto's orbit, there are still millions of ancient, cold, asteroid-like objects in a donut-shaped ring around the solar system that we call the Kuiper Belt. The question was, could the spacecraft be diverted after passing Pluto to pass close enough to some Kuiper Belt object in order to take some close-up pictures? Well, first of all, we had to find out if there was one somewhere on its path. And by commandeering the Hubble telescope and kicking off probably some very upset PhD candidates who'd been waiting years for their time, the Hubble was able to identify an object that was within reach of the mission about 2 years later. But we didn't know exactly where that object was, but it was predicted to be passing in front of several stars, occulting them. This distant object. This is way outside the orbit of Pluto. I was part of four different expeditions funded by the project, by the New Horizons project, to take telescopes to the place where the shadow of the asteroid of the Kuiper Belt object was predicted to pass across Earth. And on the fourth and final attempt, we were able to get six measurements across this object, identify its location and its shape. Turned out to be a peanut-shaped object, two round objects that had somehow come together and touched like a peanut. It's now called Arrokoth, and it's the farthest, the most distant object ever photographed by humans. Because of our work, the spacecraft was able to fly by at only 2,000 miles distant versus the 8,000 miles that they thought was the best they could do without occultation data. So we were all very proud to have gone out into the South African and Argentinian back country with these giant 16-inch telescopes and become just a part of the picket fence to help science and to make a contribution to solar system science and understanding.
If someone was really interested in getting into this kind of stuff, what would you recommend to them? Who would they reach out to? Where would they find their information?
I would say go to the website occultations.org. That's the IOTA website. And there's a form on there to send us a message inviting us to contact you. And if you have astronomical equipment that you're not getting the most use out of, or you want to try something new, this is a great way to make a contribution to science without having to go to school and get a PhD.
I'm going to put that link in the show notes so that people can just scroll right down there and click on it and check out that website. One of the things I love about astronomy is that it's still one of those sciences that relies on citizen science. And I think it's such a cool thing. Like people can, like you can just go right in your backyard and get information that's going to be used by scientists for who knows what is going to happen with that. That sounds really fascinating.
It's exciting. And in addition to the events that happen to pass right over Fountain Hills where we live, I enjoy going out into the desert and traveling with a portable telescope because the shadows don't always come to you. Sometimes you have to go to the shadows. So yeah. We call ourselves shadow chasers when we're having a beer and enjoy doing that.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for sharing with us about this. This is a little more astronomy, technical, geeky type episode than what I normally do. But I think that there are people who listen to this who really love this kind of stuff. So hopefully we have inspired somebody to take some of their free time and contribute to science.
Thanks for having me.
At the end of this episode, take a moment to stop by the Night Sky Tourist website to see an image of Ted's most recent occultation observation. You'll be able to see in the form of a graph the 13 seconds when the star went dim while an asteroid passed in front of it. You can also find a link to learn more about being an occultation chaser yourself. And while you're on the website, sign up for the Night Sky Tourist newsletters where I share exclusive content, including what to see in the night sky month by month. And this is also where I keep you updated on the book I'm writing about night sky experiences on Highway 89 from Mexico to Canada. Visit nightskytourist.com/71. That's nightskytourist.com/71. It's time for our night sky tour for early August 2023. Pause the podcast, turn off all the lights, and I will meet you outside under the stars. If you're listening to this episode on the day it was published, August 1st, 2023, there's going to be a full moon tonight. And it'll be this year's first supermoon, which just means that the moon will be at its closest position to the Earth right now. You might be hearing people talking about the supermoon, or you might read articles about how big it's going to look. But if you want the facts, you won't be able to visually notice it looking bigger. That doesn't mean you won't see an enormous full moon. Every full moon looks huge as it climbs above the horizon. The curvature of the Earth and the distance of the moon distorts our view of it when it's at the horizon. And then if you add trees or buildings into the mix, it further distorts our view. And that's why the full moon looks gargantuan when it's rising in the east. But if you go outside to look at it once it gets high in the sky later in the night, you'll see that it looks like its normal size. The distortion disappears as it gets higher in the sky. And if you love moon viewing like I do, we're going to have two full moons this month. The second is going to be on August 30th. And that second full moon is called a blue moon. You've probably heard the phrase, once in a blue moon. And we usually use that phrase to indicate that something is rare. A blue moon happens every 2 or 3 years. So in cosmic time, that hardly qualifies as rare. However, this one will be a super moon full moon. And the next time you'll see this combination is going to be 9 years from now. Now, a moon cycle lasts 29.5 days. That's how long it takes to go all the way around, go through all of its phases. And so that means that the month of February will never have a blue moon because it's only 28 days long. Tonight, we're going to spend a little bit of time with the constellation Scorpius. You can find it by facing south. It's really hard to miss it because it looks just like a giant scorpion in the sky. You'll probably notice a bright orangish colored star. That's called Antares, and it's the heart of the scorpion. Antares is the 15th brightest star in the entire night sky, and it has a mass that is 12 times larger than our sun. Antares was important in Egyptian lore because it represented the scorpion goddess Serket. It was the national star of China's Shang dynasty, and the Maori of New Zealand regarded it as the chief of all stars, while the Koori people of Australia knew it as the son of Arcturus. And Arcturus is a bright star in the constellation Bootes. So the bright red star of Antares was recognized as something special in most cultures around the world. When it comes to the entire constellation of Scorpius, again, it's recognized in cultures all around the world. And one story that's told in Greek and Roman mythology is of Orion boasting to the goddess Artemis and her mother Leto that he would kill every animal on Earth. Artemis and Leto didn't like that, so they sent a scorpion to kill him. Zeus comes along and he notices this battle, and he threw both the scorpion and Orion into the sky to remind mortals to keep their pride in check. He placed them so that they are never seen in the sky at the same time, ever. In Hawaiian lore, Scorpius isn't a scorpion at all. Instead, it is the demigod Maui's fishhook. So look at it for a moment and imagine it as a fish hook instead of a scorpion. In some of the stories, Maui is not a good fisherman. And so one day he cast his hook into the sea and it caught onto the ground at the bottom of the ocean. And as he tugged it up, he brought up the land with it. And that is how the Hawaiian Islands were formed. Watch Disney Pixar's movie Moana, and you're going to see a lot of Polynesian wayfinding tradition. And you'll enjoy the character Maui, who carries around a giant fish hook. If you can stargaze from a really dark location, look towards Scorpius, and you'll be looking right into the core of the Milky Way galaxy, our home in the universe. Summer is a great time to see the Milky Way. It moves overhead before midnight, so you don't have to stay up late, and it is gorgeous. Most likely, you'll have to travel away from home to see it, since 90% of Americans and 80% of all people on Earth can no longer see the Milky Way from where they live because of light pollution. Be sure to check out the show notes for everything mentioned in this episode, or visit nightskytours.com/71. And remember, to see the diagram of Ted Blank's recent occultation recording, you'll have to visit the website at nightskytours.com/71. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.